You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Mira Jacobs' debut novel, The Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing, chronicles the ups and downs of an Indian-American family over the course of 20 years, from India in the 1970s to Albuquerque in the 1980s and Seattle in the late 90s. It's published by Random House. It's been getting great reviews, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mira Jacob to our show. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Could you have extended this to Brooklyn in the thousands?
I maybe could have, but it would have been awkward.
You used to conduct, in fact, you founded the popular reading series Pete's Candy Store. Did you do that while you were thinking of writing this novel?
Yeah, you know, I actually started it a couple years before I started this novel. The novel actually took me 10 years to write, but a few years before that I started Pete's, mainly because I noticed, obviously, as a writer, that part of the writing life is really lonely and that a lot of people don't kind of get a chance to be out in the world. So the idea was to give people a night on a stage where they could kind of own it and be received by an audience.
Were they giving you insights into the process for yourself?
They were, actually, yeah. Actually, that's a great question, because I think over the course of time, I was there for 13 years, and it sort of became like a church for me, Pete's. It became this thing that I did every 2 weeks that reminded me that I was a writer and that stories were important, and that it was important to kind of listen.
10 years. Is it because you had to change from third person to first person or any of those kinds of things?
No, actually, it took me 10 years. I'd started writing the book, and I got about halfway into it, and my father started dying. And it was a story that I knew was about a father. I knew he was receding from the world in some way. I had this great father in there that I was kind of attached to. And then as my father in real life started dying, I stopped being able to write pretty much completely. It started slowly, and then by year three, I was done. So I stopped writing for a total of 3 years while I was in the middle of the book.
Since this is a semi-autobiographical novel, did the real events force you to rethink what you were saying about different family members?
Yeah. So what happened was, when I came back to the book, I came back with an idea that I should just jump right into it and get right back up to speed. And I found that every time I tried to write a scene with the father, I kept writing my father instead of the character I had created. And it was really horrifying, actually. It's not something you want to do. And you have this, you know, as writers, we have these very kind of big ideas about this is fiction and this is nonfiction, and I want to make that delineation really clear. And then I kept doing it. It was like this weird tick. And I finally turned to my husband at some point and I said, I'm blowing it. I'm blowing the book. I keep writing my dad. I miss him, and it's getting weird. And he kind of looked at me and he said, so what's wrong with that? And I said, well, a lot of things. You know, you're not supposed to do that. And he said, whose rules are these?
Well, you would not be the first writer to write a semi-autobiographical novel. But is he closer in it to real life than the other characters in the book?
You know, none of the things that happened to this character happened to my father. So it's a weird, it's a kind of weird thing that I've done here, which is that the events that happen are not events that have happened in my family, but the mannerisms and the way in which he reacts and the way in which he moves and the way in which I see him looking across scenes, that's all my dad.
In an essay in this month's Vogue, you write that you grew up in New Mexico. Your father was a surgeon.
Yeah.
But that was important for you to write, to tell us that even though there are similarities, this is not a memoir.
Right. Well, because
passing
there
as a novel?
Well, I think also, yeah, exactly. No, it's all just straight meat. No, it's not. The mother is, who I think is one of the most beloved characters in the book, is pretty far cry from my mother. She's the kind of more typical shut-in immigrant who's a bit scared of America. I had a really cool mom who was kind of very out in the world and political. Likewise, the brother in this is a bit of disaster. He's got a lot of kind of strong feelings and nowhere to put them. And my brother was strong in his own way, but not in that political kind of firebrand way.
The mother watches a lot of televangelists.
Yes.
On television.
Yes.
Is affected by them. Is this a way of assimilating?
You know, I think for her, it is, but it's less about that for her than this idea of Jesus and the idea that kind of at one point she has heard the words, "He will rise again," and it means something different to her than it would to, you know, a lot of other people that might hear those same words.
Well, the family is Christian, isn't it? Even though they're Tamil, from the Tamil area of India, one would assume that they'd be Hindus.
No, they're Syrian Christian, which is actually, they're from Kerala, and it's the father's family is based in Tamil Nadu, but the family history itself is from the state of Kerala, and
very leftist state.
Yeah, very leftist, very socialist. As all people from Kerala will tell you, the best state in India. So, the family is Syrian Christian, which is a minority in India, but it's also what my family is.
Mother also spends most of her time cooking traditional Indian food for the family, a way of linking to the old country. At the center of your story is Amina Ipan. When we first meet her, she's a 30-year-old photographer living in Seattle. Why did you want to tell the story from her point of view?
Yeah, Amina was a really interesting character for me because through life, she's been sort of shut down in numerous ways, and she has learned to position herself in this strange way of always being a watcher. And yet, she is the person who, as this story happens, starts to unfold the most. And she's a frustrating character for me to write, honestly, but I love that she had this sort of magic in her that was pretty deeply buried for a long time.
She's working as a wedding photographer, but her real talent is in capturing the awkward moments no family wants preserved, like a bridesmaid throwing up in the bathroom.
Yeah.
Do you see photographers and novelists as doing essentially the same thing, turning a lens on uncomfortable truths?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the things that I love to read the most really do that. They look a little harder and a little longer at things that make us bristle.
Amina had worked for a Seattle newspaper before her career imploded. What happened to make her give up a job that was so good for her? And she was so good at.
Well, what happens is she ends up seeing this event that she can't unsee, and she ends up watching a Native American man jump off a bridge, and she captures that moment. And the picture that she takes then becomes emblematic of that time. It also becomes emblematic of, you know, the state of Native Americans in America and also the media and what the media is willing to cover. It becomes this huge storm for her, and it tells her a lot of things about herself personally and the world politically that she doesn't really want to know.
Now, the book is in third person, even though it's told from her point of view. Why not tell it in first person?
It was important to me that there was a level of remove with her. It didn't really feel like a first person story. It felt like the story of a watcher and of being the person who is watching the watcher.
Thomas, the father, is a brain surgeon. He's come from the city of Salem in the Indian state of Tamil Nadu to study in the United States, and then he settles here and winds up in Albuquerque and doesn't want to return to India, even though he probably would be a star in India.
Mm-hmm. This is a pretty common story, and it's one that's funny because you don't really hear about it a lot, but in the diaspora, in the late 60s and the 70s, there was essentially in India what's often referred to as the brain drain, meaning the infrastructure there couldn't keep some of the country's best and brightest, and this was a real heartbreak. It was a heartbreak for the country. It was a heartbreak for the families that lost their sons and daughters overseas.
But that's changed today.
It really has.
In fact, Americans now going to India in what's being called medical tourism.
Absolutely. And a lot of my cousins that are there are thriving, and the democracy that's there is very, you know, dynamic and interesting. A lot of things are happening in India now that we couldn't have fathomed then.
The essay that I mentioned earlier in Vogue is called "The Arranged Marriage That Ended Happily Ever After: How My Parents Fell in Love 30 Years Later." I'm assuming that you also wanted to tell readers that your family was different than family that was here. Your parents were a lot happier in their marriage.
Yeah. I mean, there's many huge differences between the families, but the biggest, I think, is that both of my parents were thrilled to be in America, and they were thrilled to be in the American West specifically, and in New Mexico, which, frankly, there just weren't a lot of other Indians there, and I feel like they just went into it full bore and with this kind of love for the desert and the people there that was it was easy for me to kind of learn to love that too.
They also have an extended family of other Indians living in Albuquerque who are considered aunts, uncles, and cousins, although they're not actually blood relatives. Is this common among Indians living in the United States?
I think it was definitely common back then in a very specific way. I think there weren't a lot, there were so few Indians that you couldn't kind of slip back into your factions of religious differences or where you came from in the country. And I think in New Mexico at that point, absolutely. It was, you saw another Indian and you waved at them and smiled and invited them over for dinner.
Amina is the only member of her family who was born in the United States. Does that set her apart from all these other people?
It definitely does. It definitely does. It puts her more in that position again where she's observing things, and I think she feels a level of guilt and complicity for what's happening to her family around her.
Her best friend is Dimple, one of those unrelated cousins who also lives in Seattle and runs a gallery devoted to fine art photography. And she wants to show Amina's secret photos in the gallery, but Amina refuses. Why is she reluctant to show her work?
I think at the point that Dimple brings it up, Amina is so buried from herself. She's so disappointed with the turn that her career took when she took the picture of the man jumping from the bridge. I think she's so... And I think she's really scared of her own power, frankly, as a person who gets these moments. I think she's a little bit disgusted by herself, and she doesn't want the world to kind of see that.
All the men in the family have sleep issues. Thomas is an insomniac. Sunil, his brother back in India, is a sleepwalker. His son, Akhil, suffers from narcolepsy. You've called the book The Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing. Why is sleep such a problem for this family?
You know, it made sense to me when I was writing this book that if there was going to be a disease that traveled between continents and between cultures, it would be a disease of the subconscious. And it would be something that, because so much of your time is spent, especially if you're an immigrant, in this, in a way of trying to present yourself in a certain way and act in a certain way and have eyes on you in a certain way, that at night, I feel like the natural urges of your own body and your own personality sort of assert themselves. And that's what was happening with this family that was sort of broken up by the diaspora.
There's a tragedy at the center of the book, which I won't reveal here, but you do announce it fairly early in the story. Is the real story here the why rather than the what?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The what is revealed early on. And the why and how this happened and what slippage occurred in this family to let such a thing happen is sort of the mystery that you unwind as you go through it, and what we're kind of willing to watch and what we're willing to not act on is the tragedy that's holding this family, in the sort of stasis that they've been in.
This novel is being compared to the work of Jhumpa Lahiri. Should you have expected that simply because you're both Indian-American writers?
I think it's a place that's easy to go because we're both Indian-American writers. And
was she an influence?
You know, I have had many influences, and I think absolutely I'm a huge admirer of her work. I think she's amazing. I don't feel like I write very similarly to her, but I'm thrilled at the comparison.
This book, as we said earlier, took 10 years for you to write. Am I going to have to wait another 10 years to have you back on the show?
I hope not.
You're working
I don't
on something
think
else?
I am, yeah.
A novel?
I am. On to the next one.
Mira Jacobs' The Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing is published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.